From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM, and welcome new affiliates joining the very, very long Coast to Coast family list, WKIP AM in Poughkeepsie, New York. Thank you for joining. WBCK FM, Battle Creek, Michigan, and WRQO FM in Jackson, Mississippi. The list gets longer thanks to all of you. Almost 5 million Totino's and Geno's frozen pizzas with pepperoni toppings are being recalled because the pepperoni may be contaminated with E. coli. Here we go again. General Mills, which owns the Totino's and Geno brands, said the recall affects about 414,000 cases of pizza products, and there were 12 boxes of pizzas in there per case. The possible E. coli contamination was uncovered by state and federal authorities investigating 21 E. coli-related illnesses in 10 states. General Mills said 9 of the 21 people reported having eaten the pizzas with pepperoni topping at some point became ill. The people became ill between July 20th and October 10th, according to the USDA. Amazing story here out of Los Angeles. An altercation occurred on the set of NBC's supernatural show Phenomenon during its live taping. The incident involved contestant Jim Callahan, who took offense to comments made by Phenomenon judge Chris Angel, the mind freak, who fronts the show alongside our legendary friend mentalist Uri Geller, who's on the line with him now. Uri, this was an amazing story.
Yeah, it is an amazing story, and it's actually real. I got hundreds of emails today from people who thought that maybe this was staged, but it wasn't. And let me explain you. You know, for many years, there were a few magicians who made a living out of trying to debunk me.
Yes.
And Chris Angel and I, let me put it this way, I'll make it very clear. I believe that Chris Angel has been associated with some of those magicians, and I basically refused to feed into their career because, you know, he pulled out an envelope. You probably saw it, or if you didn't, millions watched the show yesterday, and he challenged not only Jim, but he also challenged me. Now, besides, why should I take a challenge of this nature? This show is a series not about us. It's not about me, and it's not about Chris. It's about the contestants. And actually, you know, off the show, Chris is a nice guy. I meet him, you know, in our dressing room. I introduced me to his brothers, to his mom. And I made a policy decades ago, almost 35 years ago, not to challenge anyone.
Right.
So in a way, it was a bizarre happening. But hey, it's live television and anything can happen.
Well, and this Callahan apparently went after Chris Angel, got very upset with him. You had to get in the middle with one of the announcers. This was going to be a real fight, Uri.
Yes, yes. It was absolutely happening very fast. And Jim was boiling and Chris jumped out of his chair and they started kind of moving to each other very rapidly. And I was sure that if nobody will stop them, there will be a fist there or someone will knock someone out. So I managed to kind of stand between Chris Angel and Jim. And then Jim, it was a little violent. He tried to get at Chris, and the host, Tim, had to actually stop him. And he almost, the host, Tim, almost fell into the audience from the podium, because the podium is pretty high. It was really quite an extraordinary, I mean, it reminded me a bit of Jerry Springer, but it was hot and it was real, and but that's the magic of live television. And one more thing, that this series continues, you know, and NBC has us every Wednesday. I think we will have to address the issue next week. And I just want to finalize by saying that there are a lot of magicians who have been nice to me also throughout the decades. And if anyone is interested to see what magicians have said about me or even scientists, just get on my website, urigeller.com. But it was quite nerve-wracking yesterday.
It was remarkable. Uri, thank you, and I look forward to seeing you two battle it out next week. That's our dear friend Uri Geller. This was an incredible situation because after performing a stunt where Callahan claimed to have been possessed by the spirit of author Raymond Hill, Callahan didn't take Chris Angel's criticism very well, and he went after him. Well, a rough day on Wall Street. Wall Street plunged, pulling the Dow Jones Industrial Average down more than 360 points as investors found themselves confronted by two very uncomfortable prospects, an end to interest rate cuts and a slowing economy. A lot of this has to do with, of course, the Fed and what they're going to do with interest rates. You know, they just lowered it another quarter point to help the mortgage business. But the market is nervously watching the price of oil, which passed $96 a barrel overnight for the first time before dipping down on profit-taking. Because I remember over a year ago, somebody was predicting that oil would hit $100 a barrel. Man, I heard that price and said, nah, there's no way, but here we go. Well, we're going to be talking about peak oil in just a moment with Matt Sevenar about all of this, so stand by for that. Russia and China have been blocking through tough U.N. sanctions against Iran, and Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said he was not worried at all about additional sanctions, dismissing them as ineffective. The U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs says that China and Russia have been stalling a new United Nations Security Council resolution since last March. Look, anything's going to happen now on this Iranian situation. Anything could happen. Paul Tibbetts, who piloted the B-29 bomber Enola Gay that dropped the atomic bomb in Hiroshima, has died. He was 92 years old, and he insisted for six decades after that war that he had no regrets about the mission, and he slept just fine at night. He suffered from a variety of health problems, and he had been in decline for 2 months. He had a very tough job as a soldier. He had to do what he had to do. Tibbetts' historic mission in the plane, named for his mother, marked the beginning of the end of World War II and eliminated the need of what some military planners feared would have been an extraordinarily bloody invasion of Japan. It was the very first use of a nuclear weapon in wartime. The plane and its crew of 14 dropped the 5-ton Little Boy Bomb, as it was called, on the morning of August 6, 1945. The blast killed 70,000 to 100,000 people, maybe more with the radiation after effects, and injured countless others. A female chimpanzee said to be the very first non-human to acquire human language has died of natural causes at the research institute where she was kept. She first learned a bit of American Sign Language in a research project in Nevada, had been living on Central Washington University's Ellensburg campus since 1980. Her keeper said that she had a vocabulary of about 250 words, although critics contended that she and some other primates learned to intimidate sign language, but did not develop the true language skills. I should say imitate. I got to learn my own words sometimes. Last month saw a record October for tornado outbreaks, with 87 twisters forming in just 1 3-day span, according to government meteorologists. The outbreak from October 17 through October 19 surpassed the previous record of 63 tornadoes set along the Gulf Coast from October 23 to 27 in 1997. A New York City politician has hatched a plan to curb the pigeon population there, drug their feed with birth control, taking a cue from a Los Angeles initiative that gave the birds a drug to render their eggs unhatchable. The councilman says this is what we need to do here. We'll see what happens. Television station in San Antonio is reporting on that chupacabra story we have been following for a long time. Phyllis Canyon, of course, who kept the head of what she believes was a chupacabra. Well, we now believe the DNA report is in, and we're going to talk with Phyllis about that now. Phyllis, they are saying that it could match a coyote. You don't agree with that, do you?
No, I don't.
What do you think it is?
Well, tonight they revealed the DNA, and that's what they said, that it was similar to the coyote. It did not have mange. So the mystery still, to me, remains as to exactly what what family genesis of coyote is this?
You had an opportunity to talk with one of the doctors here, and you asked him some questions, right?
Oh, yes, I did. As soon as he said that, my questions to him were, if this was a coyote, then why did it have the short front legs? Why did it not have any hair on it? Why were its eyes blue? Why were its ears smaller in proportion to its head? And why did it not have any teeth in between its front canines? And all of which I did not get an answer for.
Okay, Phyllis, we're going to keep in touch with you on this very fascinating story. DNA is in. The doctor's investigating, studying the DNA structure, believe that the DNA exactly matches that of a coyote. Now, I've seen the picture of the chupacabra. Many of you have also on the coasttocoastam.com website weeks gone past. And I'll tell you, it could be a mutant of a coyote. It is one weird-looking critter. In a moment, Matt Sevenar joins us as we talk about peak oil. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Matt Sevenar was born and raised in California. He received his undergraduate degree in political science from the University of California, Davis. He received his law degree from the University of California at Hastings College of the Law. He's a California licensed attorney. His work has been quoted extensively on the floor of the United States Congress and has been featured predominantly in the pages of Fortune magazine. His website, lifeafterthedoilcrash.net, assigned reading at multiple university courses around the world. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Matt Sevenar back. Hey, Matt, how have you been?
I've been good. How have you been, George?
Good. I'm doing real well. Your work continues. It's fascinating. Regardless of the debate, it's a very interesting topic. Seems to be more poignant now, Matt, than ever before, with oil hovering at $100 a barrel. Did you ever think it would be that high at this point?
Well, I've been doing this for almost 4 years now. And, I mean, I'm not, to be perfectly honest, no, I'm really not surprised. That it's at this price. When I first put the site up almost 4 years ago, it was 35 or so. And I mean, all you had to do is, you know, do some basic research and you could see that we are in serious trouble. And, you know, there's a reason Bush and Cheney decided to go into Iraq when they did. And, you know, so it really didn't take, and you really didn't need to be a genius or rocket scientist to see that, you know, oil prices are going to be going through the ceiling.
We're going to follow the program tonight based on your views that there is peak oil, and I'll have you explain that in a moment. But tell us, Matt, again, how did you, an attorney, get interested in this topic?
Well, I had just taken the bar exam and was awaiting my results, and I was putting up a website about the drug war. And the thing is, most people really don't understand how... that the narcotics and capital from the narcotics industry is a pillar of the U.S. economy because drug lords launder their money and into seemingly legitimate forms, and that money finds it into the same investment pools that all of us invest in. And so I was putting up a website trying to explain this because most people have no idea. They just think it's some guy on the street corner and they don't understand how it works into the banking system and everything else. And I came across a site called FromTheWilderness.com, and they had some really great articles on the drug war.
Michael Rupert's website.
Exactly, and he's been on the show before.
Yeah.
And I started reading these articles about oil, you know, something called peak oil, and over the course of about 4 to 6 months, the more I read, the more freaked out I got. And I didn't want to, at the time, I didn't want to have to explain the ins and outs, why hydrogen is not going to save our butts, why this abiotic oil thing is basically silliness, you know, again and again and again and again. So I put the site up. I didn't think, you know, I just figured I'd show it to my family and maybe I'd meet a few other people who were as concerned as I was, because back then nobody was talking about this. And next thing I know, I was getting, you know, 5,000 to 10,000 visits a day, and I was getting invited on Coast and, you know, so on and so forth.
And here you are.
Yeah.
Again. Well, look, I'm telling you, you make for a fascinating program, and I'm looking forward to this one as well. This is a subject that a lot of people, Matt, might not know hits home, but it is, because almost every American, every Canadian, everybody listening to this program, truck drivers, everybody is affected by the price of oil. They might not realize it right away, But it's in everything. It's in the plastics you buy. It's in what you pump into your car. It's the diesel in your car or truck. Everybody is affected by this. And I've never come across a single topic other than water and food that is so widespread used by everybody.
Well, you're right. Energy is the basis of all life. It's the basis of all economic activity. And oil is the densest form of energy ever that we've ever come across. A single gallon of gasoline, which you can buy for about $3 right now, contains in it, depending on how you do the numbers, between the equivalent of between 200 and 500 hours of human labor. A barrel of oil, which has got 42 gallons of oil in it, and which right now sells for almost $100, but historically for much less, that contains the energy equivalent of about 25,000 hours of human labor. Now, you pull that barrel out of the ground in Iraq, it costs about $1 just for the lifting costs. There's, of course, other costs associated with it. So that's basically free energy that we've been using, that we've built this magnificent society on in the last 150 years or so. We use it for everything. Your average piece of food, there's 10 calories of fossil fuel energy for every calorie of food. And that's because all pesticides are petrochemical-based fertilizers. The fertilizers get ammonia from natural gas. Natural gas, by the way, is also peaking. Then, of course, the food is stored in refrigerators, and those get electricity from coal or natural gas, and so on and so forth. Things like the desktop computer on your desk, that takes 10 times this weight in fossil fuels just to construct. Microchips are something like 30 times your weight in fossil fuels to construct. Pretty much everything around you. In fact, I sometimes when I have discussions with friends who are more religious, I say, if anything's the mark of the beast, it would be oil, because it's the only thing that you cannot, the phrase is you won't be able to buy or sell without using it. The only thing in the modern world that fits that description is either oil or the petrodollar.
We've got you for 3 hours tonight, Matt. My last hour, I've got Jerry Corsi coming back on, who's a believer in the abiotic oil theory, which I want you to touch on a little bit later on as well and get your reaction. But I want to spend some time with you, and then we'll take phone calls later on in this program so people can have an opportunity to chat with you. Peak oil. When you hear the phrase peak oil, what does it mean?
Well, oil production follows a bell curve. The peak of the curve coincides with the point at which the oil, whether it's oil field, an oil region, or the planet as a whole, reaches the 50% mark. Just to illustrate, the U.S. peaked in 1971 and has declined by 2 to 3% per year, every year, since then. And that's despite the fact that even in provinces like Texas, where there really wasn't any resistance from environmentalists, and where they just went on a drilling frenzy in the 1970s, and they threw tons and tons of money at it, they couldn't change the geology, and they declined at a rate of 2 to 3% after that. And so that's the basic idea. Now, if you listen to the big oil companies, they tell you, well, we're not going to peak for another 30 years. These are the same people who threatened M. King Hubbard and pushed him out of the industry back in 1950 when he said the U.S. would peak around 1970. And then you had people from Big Oil and from the USGS issuing reports and memos all the way up until 1975, 4 years after we peaked, that we weren't going to peak for another 100 years, and we had already peaked.
So, Matt, how do we know when we're peaking? How do we know if we've peaked? Well, how do we even know these things, even with a curve?
Well, production, you can look, the vast majority of the world is already past its peak. Really, the only regions that aren't are the regions that we just had, not coincidentally, happened to have invaded. You can look at the U.S. and, you look at what production was in 1971, and despite discoveries even in Prudhoe Bay, and production has still declined 2 to 3% per year, no matter how much money we've thrown at it. The overwhelming majority, I don't recall the exact number off the top of my head, but 99% of the world's oil comes from about 50 countries, and the vast majority of those are now past their peak. And like I said, it coincides with the point at which the oil field is 50% depleted. So once you know approximately how much oil you have in the ground, and with the technology they have today, there really isn't too much question about the about how much oil they have, because they can more or less X-ray. They use technology that it's almost difficult for me to explain how advanced it is, but there's really this isn't 1859 when they don't know how much oil is in the ground. There's pretty good estimates. And so all you have to do is estimate, okay, well, we've got X amount of oil, say the 2 trillion barrels originally. We burned through a trillion, so that's going to put us right around the halfway mark. Now,
Pat, when we come back, take this quick little break. We'll be back again. We'll get you to finish up here, and then I want you to tell us why the oil companies would basically fudge on the peak oil question. What's in it for them? We'll be back. Matt, I'll let you finish up on your phrase, and then we'll chat a little bit about the big oil companies.
I forgot what I was saying.
Okay, well, we're talking about the peak oil with the companies involved, but you were also talking about some of the oil reserves that were out there and the fact that, and I'd asked you, how do we know what a peak is and what isn't?
Pretty well. Right now, we know we have peaked, or we are in what you might call the plateau, which is sort of a peak that lasts for a few years, because we've been every oil producing province, including Saudi Arabia, has been pumping at max capacity since 2003, and production has not increased since 2004, even though prices have tripled. So that, along with the fact that Earth was originally endowed with 2 trillion barrels of oil, we burned through about a trillion. That puts us at the halfway mark, which is where the peak occurs. That gives you pretty, good evidence that that we're at the peak. And then you also have to look at the actions of our leaders. What caused Dick Cheney to change his mind about invading Iraq between 1992 and 2001? Because as you probably saw the video mm-hmm. from when he was being interviewed on CNN back in 92, he said, "Well, no, we would never. In taking out Saddam would be a big mistake because Iraq would just turn into chaos." By 2001, he had changed his mind. Well, what happened between 1992 and 2001? Well, it turned out that the oil that they thought would be in the Caspian, they thought there was going to be about 400 billion barrels. Turned out there was nowhere near that amount, and all of a sudden there's going to be a scramble for the last few virgin territory, so to speak, there in the that triangle where the border of Iran and Iraq is.
So, I agree with you on that, Matt, too.
Yeah, you look at the geologic factors, you look at the what's happened the last 3 years, and then you look at the actions of our leaders, who you have to assume, particularly somebody like Dick Cheney, you have to assume that they have information, that they may not be sharing with us.
Why do you think countries like Russia and China sit by idly and let us go into a country like Iraq, knowing the incredible proven oil reserves that are there?
Well, that's a good question. I Russia's got a lot of oil on its own. Why China sat back and let the Bush administration go in, I don't know. The thing with the Chinese, they're at the top of their government. They're much better strategic thinkers than we are, to be quite frank. And for all we know, they may have just, they tend to think 2 to 3 steps ahead, and our leaders tend to think things operate as they think they create their own reality, so to speak, which is just simply not, how life works.
Right.
The Chinese think a few steps ahead. I don't think it's completely ridiculous to speculate that maybe the Chinese have sort of let us, when you give somebody enough rope to hang themselves, mm-hmm. that they've let us mm-hmm. do that, as a country.
Well, no question. They're better chess players than our leaders.
They have a game. Russians are race playing chess. Chinese, they have a game that's even more advanced than chess. And I don't recall the name of the game, but it involves very, very critical thinking and strategic thinking. Americans, including our current crop of leaders, were raised watching television. So we're on the football team, that doesn't really have the coaches who, really know what they're doing.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about peak oil. If it's true, and the oil companies, let's say, have inflated the day. You use 30 years as an example. Why would they do that? Why wouldn't they want us to think that we've only got about 15 years of oil left, or 10 years of oil,
okay,
before
well,
we really start. Wouldn't that really push the prices up?
No, it wouldn't. What they could do is they could say, well, we've got this big reserve of oil, but we can't bring it to market, you know, for another 5 or 10 years for whatever reasons, geologic or political. Here's the thing. Let me explain how publicly traded oil companies and how investment in oil companies works. Let's pretend you or your listeners are you're an investor, and you decide to invest in oil. And the CEO of oil company A comes forward and says, look, I'm going to be honest with people. We're in really deep trouble. We've hit peak oil, or we're very close to peak oil. We're not replacing our reserve base. We're so desperate for oil that we have to scramble, 5 miles below the ocean, down around New Mexico, and we're scrambling up in the Arctic because those are the only places where there's, anything left, and we're in a really desperate situation. Then oil company B's CEO comes out and says, well, I don't know what's going on over that oil company A, but obviously they're just not very smart. Maybe they don't have very good geologists, or they just don't know what they're doing, because we've got plenty of oil. Our reserves are constantly increasing, and we're going to have more than enough. Well, where do you think the investment's going to flow?
Yeah, exactly.
It's going to flow to company B. Now, just to illustrate this in the real world, 3 years ago, Shell, there was a major scandal. Now there's a book out about it, where Shell was forced to admit that they had 20% less oil, I forget if it was oil or natural gas, but they had 20% less than they had been telling everybody. And what happened when that news got out? There was a run on their shares, which is like a run on the bank. Mm-hmm. So when people found out that they had less than they had been saying, it didn't improve their stock price.
It went
it
down.
Yeah. And here's the other thing, George. The oil companies have to create not an atmosphere of artificial scarcity, but an atmosphere of artificial abundance. Because when people think that everything's going to be A-OK and that there's plenty of oil and that the prices are going to come back down, they're much more likely to overextend themselves, buy these, bloated McMansions out in the far-flung suburbs, and then buy gas-guzzling SUVs and just go into debt and really get themselves into a hole because they think, hey, gee, the future's going to be great. There's just this guy on the television saying that there's plenty of oil and everything's wonderful. And you get people overextended, and then when the economy eventually does collapse, now you've got a very vulnerable population, and we've already, we've got a police state. You got Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown and Root building massive detention camps, and you do the math, and they think basically people have been led to believe that the future is going to be great, so that they are still left to hang out. They sort of being hung out to dry.
There's no question that the big automobile companies are making some kind of inroads into hybrid cars. They're working on this hydrogen, they're working on electrical, and they're getting there. They're getting there. It's not happening fast enough. But do you see the day, Matt, where most of our vehicles will be hybrids or all electrical, for example?
Well, address the hybrid issue first of all. If I waved a magic wand and every car, all 800 million cars on the road today, were magically hybridized overnight, we would be back to consuming the same amount of gasoline we are today within about 7 years.
Why?
Because our economy is based on growth, and you can chart GDP growth over the last 35 years with the amount of miles driven, and the two lines are almost—they're almost in lockstep. You can go to my site, scroll down to the bottom of the first page, go to the second page, scroll down to the bottom of that page, and you'll find that chart. So our economy is based on expansion. Just like the Tower of Babel was based on building up, our economy is based on building out. So we build, homes further and further away. People have to drive more. And so the consumption goes up with each passing year. Okay, back in the 50s, we were consuming globally about, I think it was 5 or 6 billion a year. Today, we're consuming 30 billion a year, because the population grows and the economy is based on fractional reserve banking, which is all about economic growth. So even if you magically make every car 30 to 40% more efficient, well, all that does is, maybe at best buy you, a few more years. Beyond that, I just saw a study that they said that the percentage of brand new cars, which are hybrids, will peak at 3% of the fleet in the year 2010. That's not 3% of the over. I mean, not 3% of the overall fleet. Just 3% of brand new cars.
Okay. That's not a lot.
No, it's not really very much at all. Electric cars are basically coal or natural gas powered cars. Natural gas in North America is also peaking. And coal, it's turned out that there's a lot less coal than we had been told. And coal production is probably peaking in about 15 years as well. So, you know, the thing is with the car, it's inherently a wasteful, inefficient form of transportation because you're using a 4,000 or 5,000 pound piece of machinery to transport in America, a single person weighing anywhere between 150 and 300 pounds. That's just not a very efficient way to move people around. So if we want to save our butts, which I think it doesn't seem like we really want to save our butts, we're going to have to get away from the car altogether and move to something like the bicycle. But I don't see that happening because Americans love their cars and they're willing to sacrifice massive amounts of blood and treasure and basically mortgage the next 2 to 3 generations to fighting over the last remaining scraps of the oil age so that we can all keep driving our cars around like we're in some state of consumerist narcosis.
I want to talk about the Middle East, and we'll be talking about it more again next hour as well. I've got to pass this on to you, though. This Chinese game of intelligence that we're talking about might be, I can't even pronounce it. It's spelled X-I-A-N-G-Q-I. And they call it Chinese most popular game.
Yeah, that might be it. I read an article. Where I got that from is that there was an article by a gentleman named Stan Goff about analyzing the different thinking patterns of our leaders, Russian leaders, and the Chinese leaders. And his point was that, you know, the Chinese have the most intellectually and strategically challenging game on which they're raised. The Russians have, then they have chess, and then we're all raised on television. So, you know. That doesn't bode well for our future.
Long term. Now, we talk about the Middle East, where half of the rumors are, or maybe even more than that, that the Middle East has 2/3 of all the world's proven oil reserves. And then there's another camp out there that says, no, it doesn't. We're wasting our time there. Where do you stay here?
Well, I don't know who the other camp is. I mean, it is a fact that they've got about roughly 2/3 of what's left. I'm not sure who the other camp is.
Well, the other camp is whatever doesn't agree with you.
Well, yeah, I mean, somebody would have to send me some, you know, articles or some type of actual factual evidence that that's not true, that, you know, that the Middle East having 2/3 of what's left is somehow false or not true. I mean, I'm just not aware of that, and it would be, you know, pretty... I mean, it's sort of like a proven fact, you know.
Have we stopped pumping? Whatever happened to the Texas oil and everything else that we used to have years ago? I've always thought we had this sinister plan, Matt, to drain the oil from other countries, and then we'd have it all here.
Well, we have pumped out about 95% of our proven reserves. Texas peaked in 1971 and declined, like I said earlier, despite throwing tons of money, removing virtually all environmental restrictions, and just letting just going on a complete drilling frenzy, Texas peaked at and declined 2 to 3% per year, every year since 1971. Now, what you said about the that's the sinister plan, that would be more what's going on in Iraq, in that, you know, we were saying before, most of the oil that's left is right there in that area. And somebody's going to be making a lot of money from it. It was either going to be the friends of Saddam Hussein or the friends of George Bush and Dick Cheney.
Right.
So
there's no doubt about it.
To have them sit, you know, you let the factions there in Iraq wipe each other out and sort of, divide, you know, get them into their three little regions. And then once they're done, killing each other, basically, then whoever's sitting on that oil basically controls the world.
And we're not pumping a lot of oil out of Iraq right now. We're relying primarily on Saudi Arabia. Kuwait, of course, I think, has a lot too, right?
Well, Kuwait, there's a major scandal going on there because they thought they had, or the claim was that they had $100 billion, and now there's a big panic over there because there's a lot of people who are saying, no, they've only got $50 billion. And you can just do a Google search for Kuwait. I think it was in Petroleum Intelligence Weekly magazine is where that story first got broke. You just do Kuwait reserves downgrade, words like that, and the stories will come up. So they may have, a lot of the OPEC countries have probably been drastically overstating their reserves, not understating them. If the thesis that the OPEC countries and the oil companies wanted to create artificial scarcity was true, then we'd have the reverse. They would be have understated their reserves, but they've overstated them. And I could explain why they, how and why that happened.
Well, is this like someone, for example, Matt, who goes out there and gets an appraiser to overinflate the price of his house, and then he borrows more money off it, even though we all know it's not worth what that guy said it was? Is it like that?
Yeah, sort of. What you can do, there are charts of what the reserve revisions were in the 80s, and you don't really even need, you don't need to be an expert in these matters to look at the revisions and go, now, wait a minute, how did they go from having 100 billion barrels to 250 billion barrels the very next year, and then there was no downgrade? They didn't show that they discovered any oil, and there was they keep each year reporting that they have the exact same amount of oil as they did the year before. That's impossible because they're pumping out X amount per year. So this is obviously, you know, these are obviously fictional numbers here, but these are really important numbers that everybody, you know, that literally the entire world is relying on these numbers being accurate. And it's obvious to anybody who can even just read that they're not accurate. And so, but everybody sort of, nobody wants to, you know, everybody's short-term interests are served by just sort of looking the other way. Long-term interests are not served at all, but we're a short-term society. So.
Oh, now, and when you say proven oil reserves, does that theoretically mean that's all they have left? That once we get to this, and let's say the proven oil reserves is 1 million barrels. Once you use up that 1 million barrels, the reserves, do they technically have any left, or they're out, they're dry?
Well, they'd be dry, but generally you don't just go dry. It goes, like I explained before, let's say a country's got or let's say Georgia Nori has 1 million barrels sitting in your backyard right now.
I wish.
Yeah. Well, what happened is you're not going to just run dry. You would, you know, pump it out, and it would reach a peak, and then it would begin to decline. Now, as it went into this decline, you might get really, you might go into a drilling and exploration frenzy there in your backyard, and you might manage to find a few more pockets, but not really anything that's going to offset the decline. And again, like I was saying earlier, the modern oil industry is probably, people think of it as sort of, they have images of, you know, from black and white images from the 1800s and early 1900s, but it's really one of the most technologically advanced industries out there, and they've got a pretty good idea. Even if they don't want to be completely honest with us, they've got a pretty good idea of how much oil there is, because the technology they have to find and map out their reserves is just phenomenal. So, you know, if there was more out there that was reasonably accessible, you wouldn't have seen a plateau the last 3 to 4 years.
With all this potential peak oil problem out there, are you saying that we need to find alternative fuels and find them fast?
Well, yeah, we need to. I mean, we're 30 years behind. It's basically 30 years too late to do that, because you need 25 to 30 years or maybe even longer to change the way your economy works, or to let market forces take the work or whatever. Now, the problem is, by the time we're motivated to do anything, which seems to be like we're just starting to wake up that we need to make some changes, it's too late, because the price of oil and fuel will have gotten to a really high point, at which point the economy is falling apart. And so then you don't have the capital and the healthy financial system that's necessary to finance all these giant alternative energy projects. You know, if I can just use an example, it's like if you are a homeowner and you drive to work every day, and if you are doing really well financially, it's pretty easy to invest in solar panels and maybe a hybrid. But if you can barely make your mortgage payments and you're not sure if you're going to have a job next week, you're not really in a position to invest in, you know, solar and maybe some type of new vehicle or whatever. And that what's true there for an individual or a particular family is more or less true for the entire country and really for the whole world.
Fascinating, Matt. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment. Lots more to talk with you about. What about these rumors about prison camps being built just in case there's chaos because of peak oil? That's next on Coast to Coast AM.